You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome back. I think the first panel sort of set this conversation up, which is looking at how the European Union engages with its neighbors, particularly those neighbors to the east. And if you look at that area, you've got a lot going on there. You have a Russia, which reportedly in the last couple of months is adopting a policy looking more to engage the West, in part searching for support for its effort to modernize. But I still think also in the context of a Russian policy that wants to exert primacy in the post-Soviet space and has some fairly definite views as to the engagement of European institutions in that area. In the case of Turkey, you have a country that is somewhat frustrated with its relations with the West, seems to be carving out a more independent course. And some analysts ask, is Turkey now turning away from Europe? And in the case of Ukraine, a fairly important election there about 3 months ago, an effort to, as the Ukrainian leadership now says, rebalance its relationships with Russia, but also in the context of saying that Ukraine still has a high priority attached to developing a strong relationship with the European Union. So what I want to do with this panel today is look at how the European Union engages with those countries. And we're talking about not just Russia, Turkey, and Ukraine, but we're talking about the Balkans, the South Caucasus, Belarus, Moldova, where there's a lot going on. And we'll start by talking a little bit about what the neighbors are looking for and then how the European Union engages with those neighbors. And we've got four excellent panelists to help us explore this question today. I won't give you long biographies. You have them in the pamphlet. But we'll begin with Ivan Krastev, who is the chairman of the board at the Center for Liberal Strategies. And he's going to help us set the context by talking a bit about what the neighbors want in terms of their relationship with the European Union. Our second speaker is Michael Lee, who's the Director General for Enlargement at the European Commission. And he's going to give us a Brussels perspective on how it views relations with the neighbors, including future prospects for enlargement. Our third panelist is Marie Mendra, who's the Director of the Policy Planning Staff at the French Ministry of Foreign and European Affairs, and she will also talk about how Europe engages with the neighbors and perhaps add some comments about the impact of the Eurozone crisis on that engagement. And then our last speaker is from the U.S. State Department, Dan Russell, who's Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, who manages relations with Russia, Ukraine, and some other countries in that part of the world. And he'll wrap up our panel presentation with a discussion on the U.S. perspective of relations between Europe and its neighbors, and perhaps give us a few comments on American policy in the region. We've asked each of the speakers to keep to about 8 minutes or so in their opening comments so that we'll have a good 45 minutes for questions and answers. So, Ivan, let me give the floor to you.
Thank you very much. Let's start with a joke that summarizes part of the fears and expectations of the neighbors. Because, you know, normally the jokes are the best summaries that you can get the situation. And this is a joke coming from the Balkans. And the idea is how you're going to distinguish between the pessimists and the optimists in the Balkans when it comes to the EU enlargement. And the pessimist is somebody who believes that Albania is going to join European Union during the Turkish presidency. And the optimist is going... is the one who believes that Turkey is going to join during the Albanian presidency. I'm saying this because from the point of view where the neighbors stand, there is not a major change. And of course, I'm going to touch on Turkey, which is a special case. But most of these countries want to be in the European Union. For them, the problem is, do they believe that European Union wants them in? So when you talk about Euro-pessimism in the Balkans, for example, it's not about being pessimistic what is going to happen when we are in the EU. The problem is, can we be there? So from this point of view, and here there are people who basically really knows what's going on. So I'll use kind of a much more marginal position to try to give a new context, because there is a major change. In the time of crisis, I do believe that you have two types of a different crisis. When there is the crisis when you don't know what to do. This is not exactly the problem with the neighborhood policy. The second part of the crisis is that you don't know why you are doing this. And I do believe that part of the problem which we see, especially in the European debate, is there is a major crisis with respect to the vision of what European Union is doing, what NATO is doing. This is not about European Union also. Just 5 years ago, the common sense was that European Union does not have neighbors. The European Union neighbors are future members. In a certain way, European Union was surrounded by future members. Because the very view of European Union and European publics about security, about European order, this is the expansion of the European Union. And of course, there was a talk about natural borders, and some are going to talk about Russia as a natural border being too vast and too different. Others are going to talk about Turkey as a natural border, but it was a local debate. The major issue was that European Union is expanding, and this is what is happening. What changed with the economic crisis, in my view, is that we basically reach certain limits, and these limits are important. One is, there is a lot of talk about publics. The interesting story about the change in European Union is that, like in many places, like in the United States, you have rebellion against the elites. Not that rebelling people has an alternative problem to, project to the EU. This is very important. People who are very unhappy about the EU, they are not happy about anything else. But at the same time, there is a major constraint. The elites are now scared, and they are not ready to do anything that public really oppose. And from this point of view, it's a major change. And when people have been basically reading also, for example, the behavior of the German government during the euro crisis and others, people matter. But people matter now much more as a negative constraint of what they are not happy to happen than basically proposing alternative what should happen. And I do believe this is one of the limits that is very important. The second is, when we're talking about limits and about integration, the truth is that there was also a kind of other limit being pushed. And this is that the current level of the integration, probably for a while, is going to be a natural border. This is the German Constitutional Court and its decision that this is the integration that basically Germany is going to tolerate. And I do believe that this is also a very important moment when we're trying to imagine how the European Union is going to develop. And the third border is about the transformative power of the European Union itself. I'm Bulgarian. So Bulgaria and Romania, unfortunately, contributed quite a lot to part of the skepticism from the side of the European public and policy elites, how much you can change societies and how quickly. Part of the disappointment in the European policy circles comes from the fact that, nevertheless, that on the level of acquis communautaire and institutional changes, everything goes very quickly. When the country signed the European Union, you start to understand that basically the change was probably less radical than many people expected. And I'm less kind of pessimistic on this. I do believe that the European Union did very well through the pressures after Bulgaria was in. But this created a new atmosphere, and to talk about fatigue, to talk about digestion, it is, in fact, to change the problem. It's much more deeper. For the first time, basically, European Union is coming with a different type of questions, and for the first time, you start to understand that probably you have also neighbors, not only future members and what you are doing about this. Secondly, I do believe we reached the point in which, for the last 20 years, it was the center of Europe, the democratic liberal center, that had been expanding. Now we see a kind of a reverse moment in which the periphery is trying basically to go back. What I mean, some of the problems that normally are going to be located in the countries that have been around European Union, you can start feeling within the European Union, especially in some countries in the periphery. On the level of governance, I can also easier give basically Bulgaria as the example, because being Bulgarian, it's always much more fair to give your own country than blame others. But in the way the creative accounting on the Greek side was something that you're going to expect basically to happen on the other side of the border of the European Union, not inside. And also part of the nationalistic type of sentiments that you can see in the member states also can be seen on the other side of the region. I'm saying this because I do believe this is a new situation, and I'm trying to basically try to describe this situation like this. European Union for a long time was talking about the emergence of the multipolar world. What we didn't predict is that we're going to see the emergence of the multipolar Europe. And this is what we're facing at the moment. I do believe that Turkey is emerging as a power of its own, with the post-Kemalist project being very much interested to democratize and basically to use European Union as an instrument for reforming its society, but basically having ambition and vision of its own. And this vision does not coincide easily with the vision of the European Union when it comes to policies, especially when it comes to foreign policy. When it comes to Russia, of course, Russia is interested in partnership and modernization, but I didn't detect a strong drive in the current Russian leadership to become part of the European Union. Basically, there is a major skepticism coming from the Russian side about the European project in general. Of course, they're respected by how rich and successful European Union is, but the very experience of the Russians with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1980s, early 1990s, makes them very skeptical to any post-national projects. So I'm saying this because in a certain way now in Europe, we not simply should say what happened in the future, but probably should look back and in a different way read what happened in the last 20 years. People believe that Europe was an uneventful place in the 1990s. It's not true. Not simply that we have the war. In Europe, the states being created for the last 20 years, basically the birth rate of new states, can be compared only with Africa in the 1960s. You have more than 1,000 of new states being created. They went in a very important state-building project, and most of these state-building projects are very controversial, very unstable. For example, in the Balkans, you cannot have simply a normal state-building project because all of these countries have been building their states and their societies as the future members of the European Union. This was a member state building. So now telling the Balkans, basically, European Union is going to wait for a while, is not an option because they don't have an alternative, not simply as a geopolitical alternative, but the very kind of a state-building project is so much rooted in the European Union and European presence that for the European Union there is not an exit strategy. In a certain way, honestly speaking, when it comes to the Balkans, the European Union has only one choice. Either basically to go with certain level of integration and getting these countries in, or acting as a type of a colonial power in most of these places, basically running protectorates. And I do believe that this is a very tough choice, but this is a choice which you cannot avoid. In the level of the post-Soviet space, nevertheless, the state building has slightly different logic. I'm very skeptical to some realists who believe that basically we can leave this part of the world to Russia and they can establish sphere of influence. I'm even not talking in moral terms. I'm very skeptical about the capacity of the Russian state to control a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space. Let's not forget that anti-Russian sentiments are one of the major resources for the state building in the post-Soviet space. They're people coming from a former colonial powers, and they know that being a former colonial power has certain advantages, but also some disadvantages. And I do believe that there are natural limits also of what Russia can achieve in a post-Soviet space. So if this is the case, for me the biggest problem is what the European Union can offer to its neighbors that is not simply promise for you're going to be member one day, the joke from the Balkans, and it is not simply let's go with the reforms because they're good to you anyway. I do believe that one of the things that European Union basically can offer is being much more involved in the process of the state building that is happening both on the Balkans with a much more clear European perspective, but also in the post-Soviet space. And from this point of view, I don't believe that for this European Union should change its instruments. Eastern partnership is an important and it is there for the post-Soviet space, but we should be much more clear of what we are doing and much more honest with the politicians there what we expect from them. Because otherwise, what I'm very much afraid with the post-Soviet space is the emergence of a very type of a cynical political elite which start to develop a Tito type of mentality, basically playing his playing quests, being radically opportunistic, but being radically opportunistic not because of trying to build a state, but much more trying to keep a bad equilibrium that exists in most of these countries. So from this point of view, for me, the short and mid-term strategy is becoming much more important than the long-term vision that's likely have been lost. What you're going to do for countries like Ukraine to be much more functional in 3 or 4 years, in my view, is much more important question than the question, when are you going to get Ukraine in NATO, or should you get Ukraine in NATO? So probably I should finish here in order to give the floor for the people who know better. But let's basically summarize the summary I started with. It is probably unlikely that Turkey is going to join Europe during the Albanian presidency. But it is also kind of unimaginable what Albania is going to do outside of the European Union. Thank you very much.
Thank you for setting that context. Michael?
Well, I think that I'm going to focus on the EU's enlargement agenda. There are many wider issues, including those that Ivan has raised, issues related to Eastern Partnership, post-Soviet space, and so on. But I'll stick to enlargement, as this is the area that I'm directly responsible for and have been involved with, indeed, for many years. Enlargement is sometimes said to have been one of the EU's most successful policies, perhaps its most successful foreign policy, even if not technically speaking, a foreign policy. The peaceful transformation of half the European continent was due to many factors, most of all factors within the countries themselves. But I think there's little doubt that the EU umbrella and the NATO umbrella contributed greatly to this transformation process. And on balance, the enlargement that concluded with 10 countries joining the EU in 2004, to be joined by Bulgaria and Romania in 2007, was a success story. Many of the doubts and fears that had been expressed in advance did not occur, whether at the level of the effects of labor migration, although here and there it did exceed expectations, or dislocation of industry, yes, a problem in some parts of Europe, particularly those parts bordering directly on new member states, but on the whole, or the fear that the EU institutions would break down and would not be able to function properly with 27 member states, these fears did not occur. And if you look at the way the EU's institutions have been functioning over the last few years, both before the entry into force of the Lisbon Treaty and now afterwards, we can see that the Council of Ministers takes decisions, the European Parliament fulfills its role, the whole range of EU policies, from competition policy, agricultural policy, you name it, have been functioning more or less effectively. We faced enormous new challenges over the recent period, which raise issues of their own. But if we confine the discussion to the impact of the fifth enlargement, many of the doubts and fears were not realized, and on the whole, I think one can claim that it was a success story. Even with Bulgaria and Romania, where questions are sometimes raised, Ivan has convinced me that the leverage not only before accession but after has helped the reform process, and we've seen major efforts to fight organized crime and corruption, which are continuing today. However, this success was not widely perceived as such by the European public, and I think it was very little explained to public opinion. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find speeches by leading European leaders, statesmen, diplomats, over the last 10-year period, which clearly set out for public opinion why we were engaged in this enlargement process, and quite simply, why we felt it was in the interest of the European Union, the original member states and the new member states, to pursue this process. Whether cast in broad terms of stability, security, and efforts to promote prosperity throughout the continent, a new market of 100 million consumers with rising incomes, whose macroeconomic performance on the whole was rather stronger than some of our old member states, with exceptions, of course, the public was left perplexed and perhaps was left with the impression either that this was a type of charity or a reward for overthrowing communism, not something that we had decided because it was to the benefit of the European Union as a whole. That was, in a sense, the inheritance of the fifth enlargement. Many studies have been made. We tried to publicize the results of these studies, indicating the economic impact in objective and, I think, on the whole, positive terms, but these have had very little impact on public opinion. So when we turn to the existing enlargement agenda, which covers the countries of what are now called the Western Balkans, Turkey, and most recently Iceland, that has applied for membership in the EU, we have, against a background, let's say, misperceptions or doubts and hesitations about the fifth enlargement. If I were to summarize the main challenges facing our enlargement policy today, I would say that they are, on the one hand, how to make the perspective of EU accession, which may in many cases be several years away, sufficiently tangible and credible for the population, that we have the necessary leverage with the governments and the parliaments to continue to push for the necessary reforms, political, economic, legal reforms. How can we do that on the one side vis-à-vis partner countries? And how, on the other side, can we maintain public support for enlargement, which is wavering for various reasons, in the existing member states? If we take the side of the partner countries, it's true, it's a medium to long-term perspective for many of the countries. As you may know, there are now, formally speaking, three candidate countries, Turkey, Croatia, and the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. I won't go into any detail now, but Croatia is approaching the final phases of its accession negotiations, even though there are still many open issues. And I think even Ivan is right to suggest that the experience with Bulgaria and Romania is to some extent conditioning the approach vis-à-vis Croatia and the other countries. Turkey poses many challenges of its own. We began negotiations in 2005 at the same time as we did with Croatia. Progress has been much slower, but even so, until now, under each presidency, we've managed to open a new chapter. And to a remarkable extent, despite all the political noise that one hears on both sides, doubts and hesitations in some quarters in the EU, public opinion in Turkey, the position of some political parties in Turkey and others, doubtful about this process, the bureaucracy in Turkey remains really tuned into this. The European Integration Secretariat has been beefed up. A minister was appointed with special responsibility last year pursuing this agenda, directly reporting to the Prime Minister. And at the bureaucratic level, whatever may be happening of a political nature, whatever incidents may come along, there is slow and steady progress in adapting legislation, changing institutions, even in Turkey, where the challenge is perhaps greater. Iceland is a story in its own right. Maybe we'll reserve that, if anyone's curious, for questions and discussion. So how can we make this perspective credible, tangible in the candidate countries and the potential candidate countries? I think the main way is to show, as in the case of Croatia, that the perspective of joining the EU is real, that a country which meets the necessary conditions actually can and will join, and that this is not just the idle talk of politicians about which the public may be very skeptical. And for the countries which are still held back by issues, state-building issues, issues which are hangovers from the dreadful wars of a decade or so ago, disputes over minorities, over frontiers, other bilateral issues, which mean that in addition to the normal transition questions, we have these post-Yugoslav issues to deal with as well, state building, member state building issues as well. There, I think it's very important that we should continue to deliver benefits from this process progressively along the way so that it retains its credibility. It's not just light at the end of a very distant tunnel. And strangely enough, in a picture in which 2009, 2010 have been difficult years, we have had some remarkable successes, of which I think the most striking in the last 18-month period has been visa liberalization. And I think one of the things that that has showed in the case of the countries of the Western Balkans is that if you have a goal that is sufficiently attractive, that has resonance with public opinion, and that requires specific benchmarks to be met, even quite demanding ones, to get there, countries, even those facing serious state-building issues or governance issues or bilateral disputes with their neighbors, are actually quite quickly able to make the necessary reforms. So we abolished visa requirements for three countries last year. We've now proposed they be abolished for Bosnia and for Albania, and probably they will by the end of this year, which I think is a remarkable achievement given all the constraints, the challenges, the difficulties. And it's something which enables business people, young people, academics, and others to see that there are actually benefits along the way. And I think we have to be creative and imaginative about that. And as we're into a medium-term perspective, to think of other such steps which progressively can make this a meaningful and a real process for public opinion in the candidates and the potential candidates. What can we do on the other side in our member states to keep public support and political support? I think, first of all, and politicians are most reluctant to do this, we need to explain, and not to get tired of explaining to the population, why we're in this business at all. And to have the topic, even if it's not an immediate vote winner, included more and more in public discourse so that people can understand that it's in our own interest. And I think we can demonstrate in many concrete ways, whether the fight against organized crime and corruption, whether preventing trafficking of drugs, human beings, or what have you, that there are benefits to us along the way too, and that this is not something that we're just doing for the greater good. We can also remind countries about geography. And people are rather vague. I have a son who's a geographer. I'm rather weak when it comes to geography myself. But all of the countries of the Western Balkans are entirely surrounded now by member states. And for us to achieve our own objectives with regard, for example, to trans-European transport networks, to interconnectedness with gas and electricity networks, we can't do that without the involvement of these countries. So I think we need to explain this too. But as far as the actual preparations for membership is concerned, the deal essentially is that we keep our commitments to the countries in the region, however difficult the process may be. We don't walk away, and we have not walked away in any case, even the most difficult and the most challenging. But the quid pro quo for that, in a sense, is that we do have rigorous conditionality. And my institution is the institution, in a way, which is charged with monitoring the implementation of the conditionality and seeing that the pace at which a country approaches the EU is a reflection of the pace in which it meets very explicit and well-established benchmarks. It's sometimes said that the bar has been raised for these countries compared with the fifth enlargement. There's an element of truth in that, but I think perhaps one could say better that the kind of benchmarks which were implicit very often in the last accession negotiations are now explicit. And this, if anything, is helpful because it means that the countries know exactly what they have to aim for, and it gives us a completely objective basis for reporting. So for the enlargement agenda, which is perhaps not the top priority under existing circumstances, and where the backwash from the economic and financial and sovereign debt crisis no doubt influences opinion, even in countries which are most steadfast in support of the enlargement agenda, I think it's this twin approach, which is based on delivering benefits along the way and making the prospect of accession as credible as possible in the partner countries, while taking conscious steps to maintain public support through emphasizing interests, specific interests, showing benefits along the way to our own members, and insisting that people approach the EU on the basis of conditionality. It's the best policy we've got. Of course, there are individual issues which are intractable, which need to be tackled, bilateral questions, state-building questions. Turkey, the Cyprus problem raised many specifics which cannot be handled overnight. But nonetheless, I think this policy is tried and true, and if we can stay with it, I think it will bring benefits, albeit in the medium to long term. Thank you.
Thank you. Marie?
Thank you, Steve. A few weeks ago in Paris, in the Ministry of Foreign and European Affairs, we celebrated 60 years anniversary of the Schuman Declaration. And we had invited friends and personalities from, you know, many countries from you know, India, China, Russia, Brazil, and it was striking to hear the very different perceptions and views of what Europe was, should be, will be. And if you think of what, you know, Robert Schuman and the other great Europeanists in 1950 had in mind for Europe, they certainly could not envision a 27 member state community in 2010. What I'm trying to say is that the history of the European Union, the building of the European Union, had no predetermined history or scenario. It's always been invented. It's been constantly invented, and expectations and disappointments, I think, about Europe, have been in a way even stronger outside Europe than inside. Because for those who are not in the building process, which has been a formidable process, but also extremely painful, bureaucratic, difficult, making so many concessions, changing habits, changing mentalities, that for those who have not been dealing with the process day after day, probably expectations could be much much higher. And what is interesting is that in the process of all those decades, then the European Union, that went to be a relatively modest community of European states, has become a big community, extending, you know, eastwards, and that has to think and maybe act as a global power. But again, that was not in the process of building a community of states, where, I mean, basically the idea was that national states decided to give away part of their sovereignty for much better deals and better economic governance, more prosperity, and of course, peace. And again, you have to remember that that all happened at the very beginning of the Cold War. Now, I take another example. If you had told Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev in 1987-88, when you know he was all excited about his paradigm of the common European home, that a common European home 25 years later would be a community of 27 states, including three former Soviet republics all the socialist countries of the Warsaw Pact, and that, of course, Russia would be outside enlargement of the European Union, because, you know, Russia, without the Western republics of the Soviet Union, didn't feel interested in being a candidate member to the European Union. I think this Gorbachev would not have understood that kind of scenario, which, of course, no one envisioned at the time. The point is that, and it's always also very interesting to travel and be listening to how American friends, you know, Russian friends, and talk about the European Union. I'd like to start by saying that Europe, and certainly seen from France, and I guess probably the same in Germany, in Britain, in Spain, in Italy, Europe is, one, the European Union. Second, 27 countries. And third, it is a continent that has no defined or fixed borders, east and probably south also. I think one has to keep in mind that when you say Europe, and in a European country, you have those several definitions or concepts or realities all together. And so it is a bit difficult for a European citizen, a European expert, to hear views that are, the European Union now that is preparing to be a post-Lisbon treaty. It just has to be the European Union, period. You send two or three of your EU representative, they are Europe. Why should member states still be represented, for example, at the G20? Or I think this is a misunderstanding. The EU is becoming better organized and has the ambition of having a foreign and security policy, and I think rightly so, because, again, the world has been changing, and as I think Ivan, or it was earlier in the earlier panel, I think Mark was saying that, it's the first economic power today, or, and it's very big in trade, and so it has become a global power, but without the intention in the building of the European Union. It certainly was not a priority to be a global power. So, yes, this is it. The problem for the European Union today is to find its role, to define its function in a globalized world that is changing very, very fast with many new constraints. But it still is a community of 27 national states that don't have identical domestic policies or regional or foreign policies. And that will continue to be so for many years. The whole thing about the European Union construction is to try and come to better consensus and to some consensual policies all together. But always knowing that the national states will retain their own identities, their own pet subjects, regional engagements, and the like. So it's always a matter of compromise, objectives are never fully met. And geography continues to matter, because the European history is a history of proximity. It's not a history of a major alliance, across the continents, or it's not the transatlantic alliance with a major ocean between the United States and European allies. It has very much to do with proximity, with geography. This is why future enlargement is a more complex issue today than it was, 10 years, 20, 30 years ago. Because, proximity, when you think about Turkey, when you think about the North African countries, but Iceland, it has become a different issue. I think it will happen, along different lines and with new perspectives and new constraints. The formidable achievement of the European Union after the Franco-German reconciliation of the 1950s has been the transition out of communism and the peaceful integration of countries that had lived in a completely different universe for a number of decades. That accomplishment cannot be, I think, tarnished by the many problems and crises that have erupted in the last 20 years or so. And that major success was also a transatlantic success, because it could be achieved only with another enlargement, with the enlargement of the Atlantic community and NATO enlargement. And I've been so keen to follow those developments in the last 20 years as a scholar that I can advise the French ministry and French government about policies I feel how important it is to remember how all this became possible. You know, all the sacrifices that were made, but the extraordinary satisfactions and achievements. Now, if we move on to what the problem is today, maybe an anecdote of two very brief anecdotes. I was sitting in a plane a few years ago and sitting next to going to Riga, and next to me was a young Latvian, and we started talking in Russian, and I said, well, you know, it's now we are co-citizens, because, you know, Latvia had joined the European Union, and this, you know, 25-year-old young man looking at it, how come? I mean, how can we be co-citizens of? Well, I said, you know, you have joined the European Union, so you are a European citizen, and I am a European citizen. He had never thought about it, you know. It's just a major discovery that, yes, he was. We had something immediately in common. Another anecdote is talking to experts of Moldova, and Moldovan foreign minister is coming to Paris after tomorrow, and also the Georgian president, Saakashvili, is expected in Paris on Sunday. And so in Moldova, more and more people are getting Romanian passports. So they are becoming European Union citizens. But most of them don't realize it. I guess what I'm trying to say is that we are talking of borders, we are talking of limits, we are talking of enlargement that is stalled for some time probably, and suddenly we'll be much slower, and I think also under new rules, and it won't be just a continuation of previous enlargements. But that things are not just, you know, set there, that it's just one border. It's much more complicated. And this is what makes our policies difficult. This is what makes Russia's interference uncomfortable, to say the least. Because, again, I mean, yesterday I was thinking about at my talk today, why is it that so many countries have been wishing and willing to join the European Union, when we see, you know, what a headache it can be with a financial crisis, with debts, with bureaucracy in Brussels, sort of constant infighting. And then it came to me just as so obvious. It is the great desire and the necessity to belong somewhere, to belong to a community. It is very uncomfortable for a country like Moldova, Georgia, Ukraine, and even Belarus, I'm sure. And certainly, I'm sure, Armenia, Azerbaijan, not to belong to any community. The CIS hardly exists. They don't trust Moscow. We all know this. So I think it is this necessity to belong, which is, of course, much stronger in Europe, that is made of relatively small nation states or regions or territories, and so different from the United States, that is, in a way, almost a continent in itself, with, you know, with only, you know, the major neighbors of, you know, Canada and Mexico. So this necessity to belong, I think, has to be fully understood, because this desire and necessity will continue to be there. Russia does not offer a true community. It's amazing to me, I'm a Russia specialist, and that, you know, that in Moscow there was no one to come with ideas of offering to former republics, former satellites, some form of community where you get some of your interests as a nation to be part of a bigger entity, you know, for economic reasons, migration reasons, cultural reasons, but for reasons that are certainly post-imperial syndromes and the dramatic economic crisis in Russia in the 1990s, none of that could be offered by Russia. And so now, when the Russian leadership comes with a different kind of policy, which I think comes much too late, we have to change our options, our policies in Europe and in NATO, and find new ways. And this, we are at this crossroads now. And basically, what does Russia want? Russia wants to prevent any of the states in between, those that don't belong to NATO or the European Union, prevent any of those countries to join any entity or community of which Russia cannot be a member or will not be a member soon. Think about it. And I think this is really the Russian bottom line. And which explains a lot of what happened in Georgia, in Ukraine. And you probably know that the new government in Moldova is a coalition entitled the Alliance for European Integration. This is the name of the alliance in power in Chisinau. So this is our new challenge in Europe. And when I mean in Europe, I mean in the European Union, in Brussels institution, I mean in France, in Germany, in Latvia, in Spain, and I mean also on the continent. That is, all those who live and work in Europe, have an interest in Europe. So it's also, of course, the transatlantic community, because most of the members of the European Union are NATO members and have a very, very close alliance and relationship with the United States. So I guess it is absolutely crucial today, if we want to devise new policies towards those countries that will continue to want to belong to our communities, devise new policies for the 5-10 years to come, and not sort of feel that we have to stop and wait and freeze situations. Because then we'd get to a security problem, I think, in Europe, east of Europe, with the in-between states. That would be, I think, worse than the frozen conflict that we haven't been capable of managing, and with the tragedy in Georgia in August 2008. So we'd have a sort of security situation with frozen states. That is, with states that have to stick to the status they have today, which is a non-defined status. I think it is dangerous. I don't think it is a stable status quo for the years to come. And without damaging the security and political relationship with Russia, it is absolutely crucial, and it is certainly the position of the French ministry to continue to engage very actively with Georgia, with Ukraine, with Moldova, and all those countries, and to put the subject on the table in Brussels, in Washington, and have that in mind, because those countries cannot be kind of the hostages of European of the European economic problems today. That said, I will conclude by saying that if the EU enlargement had to make a pause, it's not only because of EU problems of EU choices. There is also one reason why it's stopped a few years ago. It's that some of those countries have not been able to make the political progress that was expected from them. And if you take a country like Ukraine, it is clear that one of the reasons why the partnership and with Ukraine could not progress as planned, it's just because the political regime and the economic governance were so critically inefficient that it was difficult from the part of the European Union and European countries to continue to fight and motivate public opinions and institutions for a potential integration of countries that continue to be ill-governed. And so the problem is really very much the interaction between the two, that is, between what happens in the candidate members and those countries who continue to wish to integrate our communities, and the situation in our European countries and what we continue to be capable of offering under what conditions. And all this, I think, has to be redefined and readjusted to the current situation. Thank you.
Dan?
Well, let me try to be brief. I'd say first I welcome the opportunity that Steve's given me to comment on someone else's foreign policy, since usually I'm on the receiving end. So this is a pleasure. I was struck at the EU-Russia summit in Rostov-on-Don by Van Rompuy's comment that what EU-Russia relations need are, they don't need a reset. They need a fast forward. But before I would turn to that, maybe a couple of comments on how Russia views the EU, at least from my own perspective. And I think that, I'd make three comments. The first would be about Russia as an actor on the world stage. My friend Dmitry Trenin a few years ago called Russia very old Europe. And there's some truth to that. And what he was really talking about, I would summarize, is the current Russia as a sovereign great power with a non-ideological worldview, and its policy towards Europe has usually met policy towards its biggest bilateral partners, to the big what it perceives as the big countries in Europe. And I think it's going to be a while before they adjust to, Marie's EU as a global power, or even as a community of nations acting in concert. I think at the same time, Russia is doing the same thing the rest of us are, trying to adapt, to the realities of the postmodern world. And our interaction, both the United States and the EU, has changed now that we're having, we're dealing with Russia as a partner in the G20. Russia is, finding its own way with the other BRIC countries. So, and we're all dealing with interdependence, which was painfully driven home by the global financial crisis, not only in Moscow, but certainly here and in Europe's capitals. Second point I would make is about Russia domestically at home. Russia is still in the midst of whatever you want to call it. It's post-imperial, post-communist transition, and this is going to take, a long time, and it's far from over. their leadership now, the current leadership, is very interested in modernization. And there's a lot of talk about innovation economy, about new ideas, as well as some familiar themes like rule of law in that context. And that's certainly something we should all pay attention to and take advantage of. The third I would emphasize is that when we tend to look at Russia, we all tend to be very leadership-driven on looking at Putin and Medvedev and kind of the upper strata. And I think we just need to be careful not to lose sight of how much Russian society has changed since the breakup of the Soviet Union. And I say that as somebody who's lived there 7 of the last 15 years, and I mean the changes in society and among people I know are pretty striking. And I mean, if you look at the urban elites and the emerging middle class, you see a thirst for travel, for consumption, for connections with the modern world. And, you know, if you ask anybody who lives, west of Siberia, they're going to talk, they will picture their country as a bridge between Europe and Asia spanning two continents. But if you ask them who they are, they'll tell you they're Europeans. That doesn't mean they have the same sense of belonging to a greater European community. But they still self-identify as Europeans. Against this backdrop, I think it's an interesting moment for EU-Russia relations. And I'd focus on the summit earlier this week just because it's kind of an interesting data point. It's really the first EU-Russia summit, post-Lisbon Treaty. And it's certainly at a time when Europe is grappling with its own, internal financial crisis. And, there are a lot of views of Europe's policy from Washington. Some, American commentators looking at EU-Russia relations, call it dialogue at any cost. I think that's unfair because, if you look at the agenda in EU-Russia relations, it looked pretty familiar to anybody who's involved with U.S. policy towards Russia. The four common spheres of the 16-year-old, partnership and cooperation agreement pretty much mirrors our own agenda, although we in the United States would certainly use different terms to describe a lot of this stuff. But if you look at the baskets of economics, of freedom, security, and justice, of external relations, and of research and education, or what we would probably call, people-to-people contacts, there's the agendas aren't in many ways all that different. When I look at the joint statement on modernization that was put out in Rostov, again, I see a lot of commonalities with our own policy, looking for, expanding opportunities for the key sectors that are driving growth and innovation, the importance of working on rule of law, fighting corruption, the support by the European Union and the United States for early WTO accession, and, of course, the emphasis on, trade liberalization. And I don't think this is a unique event. If you look back at Stockholm at the meeting in November, a lot of the trends that are highlighted in Rostov really began then. So if I were looking and trying to summarize, from my own perspective, kind of the EU's policies, I would say it's partnership, minus institutionalization. That's there's no shared institutions certainly at this point. But I think there's a recognition that Russia's own modernization agenda offers an opportunity to regain some of that momentum of the agenda of the transformative agenda of the 1990s, albeit in a very, very different way. At the same time as I look at the EU, and visa-free regime is something that Russians are very, very interested in and pushing hard for. And while there are many people looking at that as a goal, when you look at Poland and the other countries within the EU that have, in many ways put a brake on this by saying you need not only to look at Russia but at the six Eastern Partnership countries at the same time, you can see some of the divisions and the interplay. And I think while the U.S. and the EU have many of the same goals, I mean some of the differences between us are blindingly obvious. Again, a couple people, Michael and Maria have both talked about geography. And the other part is economics. The EU has a far bigger economic relationship with Russia than the United States does, or probably than the United States ever will. Russia is Europe's third largest trading partner, yet only 1% of U.S. trade is with Russia, just by comparison. The difference in investment is not that stark, but still, Europe is clearly number one. The United States is down around number six, and of course there's the energy relationship, which is very immediate and direct for Europe, not so much for us. At the same time, I think our common interests are pretty much the same in Russia in many ways, and as I look at our own relationship as we enter, year two of the infamously misnamed reset, I think you're going to see actually more commonality. We spent a lot of time in year one on the START Treaty, on nuclear security agenda, and clearly the United States will be very driven by its own security agenda with Russia, with Afghanistan, counterterrorism, and all of these issues. But there's certainly recognition here that economics need to play a bigger role in our relationship. And one of the big problems in U.S.-Russia relations is the lack of stakeholders, something that the Europe does not have an issue with. We're going to be focusing more on a niche market, on high-tech aviation. There's some clear areas where there is overlap, but it's never going to be like the relationship between the countries of the European Union and Russia on the economic front. Just a few words on some of the other countries, and I'll just pick out two or three. Ukraine, obviously, a big important country to the United States and to Europe, and I think there again we have pretty much a shared agenda. We were both big supporters of free and fair elections and the transition of power. We're both big supporters of an IMF standby agreement with conditionality for Ukraine, and those are kind of the pillars. But Ukraine has a lot more to gain from Europe than it does from the U.S., quite frankly. And when they look at an association agreement, at a free trade agreement, at visa liberalization, these are the three big things that I think Ukraine wants, and only Europe can provide those. At the same time, in our own bilateral U.S.-Ukraine Strategic Partnership Commission, we're reinforcing many of the same trends that our European colleagues are with Ukraine. The Eastern Partnership, which the United States supports, and we're trying to cooperate and collaborate more with our European colleagues, on assistance and on messaging to countries. And I think you can see it. Marie mentioned Moldova, the little democracy that could, that I think we're both trying to support at this point. Much tougher case in Belarus, where there are a lot of issues, and we're trying to stay on the same page, both in terms of dealing with the human rights situation there and some of the very real problems. Georgia's a special case, I think, certainly after the Russia-Georgia war. Europe has the two key things there, I think, are the EU monitoring mission, which is really the only international presence, in Georgia. And then there's the Geneva process, where we're working with Pierre Morel and others to try to at least find some road towards better security and stability, although I'll tell you, none of us are having much luck with the Russians on that front. But this is, this is going to be a work in progress. I think, enlargement is not something, at least I see, in any of these countries as an immediate goal. And I think Marie's right that there's going to have to be some retooling. But at the same time, I don't think we, the United States or the European Union, are going to have a successful policy or encourage the kind of change and trends we'd like unless we manage to work together on this stuff. So why don't I just stop there and
Thanks, Dan.
Back to Steve.
Okay, let's go ahead and open up the floor to questions. I'm going to extend this session to 1 o'clock. But let's take 3 questions. Please keep them short. Please identify yourselves and wait for the mic. Right in the back there, last row.
Alexander Melikishvili, Georgian Service of Voice of America. I have 2 very brief questions. First has to do with there's recent news about the initiative by the EU Foreign Policy Chief, Lady Catherine Ashton, which was actually revealed on May 28, on the eve of the EU-Russian summit. And this has to do with scrapping of the position of special representatives for South Caucasus and Moldova. Does it imply that these regions, the South Caucasus and Moldova, fall below the EU radar? That's the first question. And the second has to do with the visa liberalization, and this is to Mr. Michael Lee, actually. The next round of the Georgian-EU negotiations about visa liberalization is supposed to be this fall. How would you describe the prospects for visa liberalization with regard to Georgia? Thank you very much.
Okay. Right there in the front.
Natalie Tocci, Transatlantic Academy and Istituto Affari Internazionali. I had a question for Ivan. You posited the very interesting idea of a multipolar Europe, and you mentioned Turkey as being one of the possible poles. Now, what is clear is that Turkey's foreign policy has become increasingly active and perhaps even increasingly independent. But when we think about a separate pole, it's, if you like, an understanding that emphasizes the differences between Turkey and the European Union. Now, of course, there are many differences on the table, some of which we are sort of living through as we speak. Certainly as far as Iran and as far as Israel is concerned, the differences are there and apparent. But in a different kind of way, we could look at it as an extension of the European pole through Turkey, in particular in the Middle East. Ultimately, if we look at the way in which Turkey's acting, it's acting in many respects in a quintessentially European way. Its foreign policy is predominantly about trade, about investment, about the movement of people, about visa liberalization. It's about, if you like, constructive engagement rather than punitive action. So in many respects, we could look at Turkey as being more European than the Europeans, especially as far as the Middle East is concerned. Thanks.
Okay, and then right next to you.
Cornelius Ochmann, Bertelsmann Foundation, Germany. I have 1 comment and a question to Michael Lee. My comment goes in this direction that highest or biggest challenge for the European Union would be in the next years how to bring together the modernization strategy with Russia, with the Eastern Partnership. Because we cannot speak with the Russians about the visa-free regime without negotiations with Ukraine and the other countries in Eastern Europe. Is there any strategy or other contacts between the peoples who are working with Russia and Ukraine? And can we expect in the next time Eastern strategy of the European Union?
Okay, well, the Europeans to take the first crack at those questions.
There's 1 more.
No, we'll go ahead and answer them. Marie, do you want to?
No, I think the questions were for Ivan and Michael.
Just basically touch on the Turkey issue. I also agree with you that it's much more interesting and complex than it looks like. If you compare Turkish foreign policy with the Russian policy, for example, 2 years ago, where basically the idea was how different Russia is, Russia was trying to position itself as the alternative to the European Union. It was other Europe. by the way, Europe of the 19th century, with a strong idea of sovereignty and so on and so on. The very idea of the sovereign democracy was about this. It didn't work well. And I do believe that part of the change of the Russian policy has a lot to do with the fact that this type of a soft power of Russia appeared to be not strong enough, and it was the fall of the Russia-Georgia war and basically the failure of the Russian diplomacy during the Shanghai meeting to convince anybody to recognize South Ossetia and Abkhazia that basically created this kind of a paradoxical situation. Turkey was very different. Turkey integrated EU soft power in its own soft power. Basically, Turkey was going on many places in the world as kind of a Europe, but Europe which understands others, Europe that can speak to the Muslims and others. But at the same time, let's also face it kind of honestly, Turkey is not interested to be part of the common European foreign policy. And this was what happened as a surprise for Europe. Those who have been strongly proposing Turkey to become a member of the European Union, most of their arguments have been security arguments, that it is going to be important for Europeans to become a global power. The idea was to integrate Turkey as part of the European common foreign policy. Turkey's position was, we're very much interested in the common market, we are very much for democracy, and this is a government that is opening society, but we have our own foreign policy vision. And what is happening in Europe, because it's not only Turkey, Russia is a power of its own. If you see the intensity of the contacts between Russia and Turkey for the last year, this is something interesting happening on the level of Europe. And basically, when I said that in a certain way, periphery now is much more expanding than the center, it also has to do with this much more like-mindedness support for independent foreign policy within the European paradigm. And I do believe this is important. And from this point of view, how European Union is going to manage its relations with Russia and Turkey, and not only with Russia and not only with Turkey, is a totally different job. And by the way, when we're talking about even the post-Soviet space and when we're talking about the Caucasus, it's not only European Union and Russia. Turkey has also a view of its own. Turkey was a major player after the Russia-Georgia war. They have an initiative of their own. And in the way they're, for example, active on Iran, we can imagine them to come with a third position also in some of these issues. So from this point of view, in my view, these three polls does not mean that we are going to meet only competition, but it does not mean that they are going to be only cooperation. I have been also strongly opposing the idea that everything in the post-Soviet space should going to be a zero-sum game between the West and Russia, because when you're doing this, you're becoming the hostage of the other side. In a certain way, for the last 2 or 3 years, many of the things that NATO and the West do was not because we believe that it's right, but because we believe that we should do it to show the Russians that they cannot have veto on our decisions. So in a certain way, you're moved and you're pushed by the others, simply basically saying no. I do believe that this type of dependency also should be broken, because it's a dependency not weaker than the one that you're all going to say yes in order to please the other side. But it's a new game. I do believe that we should take Turkey seriously. And for example, Turkey's role on the Balkans shows that it is part of the European vision, but at the same time, they have a priority of their own. And this priority of their own are not always going to come in harmony. If you're going to imagine Turkey being part of the European Union, I'm going to be interested what was going to happen if you're going to have these three Turkish ships, members of the European Union, going to the Israel border on Gaza, and how the conflict is going to look like then. Is it going to be different? Who is going to react? How? So I do believe the situation is going to be slightly more complex than we imagined in the late 1990s.
Well, just on that one, I think it's been clear over the last couple of years that since Mr. Davutoğlu, in fact, became Turkish foreign minister, that they have been very vocal in putting forward Turkey's foreign policy agenda, which has been expressed as a policy of zero conflict with neighbors, essentially. I mean, apart from some of the more spectacular incidents, such as the one that Ivan referred to, broadly speaking, that's how it's presented. And it's also presented by Mr. Davutoğlu as a complement to relations with the EU and not as alternative. course, there are others who present it differently and who say, well, basically, if the West doesn't want us, then we have other options. But I think viewed in the first context, one can see that this would have a powerful attraction for many in the European Union. And if indeed, over and above some particular moments which might be difficult, such as the last couple of days, the question of the Tehran research reactor, which has been discussed here in the last couple of days, broadly speaking, if Turkey succeeds in this policy of zero conflict with neighbors and manages to intensify cross-border links with Syria, with Lebanon, and with others, and therefore contributes to creating a peaceful neighborhood of its own, which is the proclaimed objective, I think that could only be something which the EU would applaud. Much depends on the evolution of EU-Turkey relations in the future and whether sort of demagogic presentation of issues can be avoided on either side and whether indeed we stay on track in terms of accession negotiations and so on, in which case I wouldn't see this business about alternative pole. I would see it much more as a policy which potentially, if wisely pursued, could be a complement to the CFSP.
Other questions?
In the back also. In the back.
Chris Bladavsky from Manufacturers Alliance. A couple of years ago, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine opened the doors to a fast-track possibility of Ukraine acceding to the Euro-Atlantic institutions, notably the EU and NATO. But the EU was quite strongly opposed to that. I've got a question to the three European panelists. Would you say that 20 to 30 years from now, that decision will be considered a strategic success for the EU, or would you say that it will be a less than strategic success? Thank you.
Okay. Take two more questions in the very back there.
Mary Dominic, I wondered if Madam Mendras would address the question about the Council of Europe, which was also one of the forerunners or one of the corollary institutions that you contributed to post-war Europe. Will the enlargement of the European Union presage the dismantling of the Council of Europe, and how does that affect Russia and Turkey? Thank you.
Okay. Let's start with the Ukraine question. In 25 years from now, will EU policy be looked back as having been a success or failure?
I do believe that.
The response to the Orange Revolution.
I'll be very brief on this because in 25 years, you know. former Vice President Dan Quayle used to have a famous quote that the future is going to be better tomorrow. So from this point of view, I expect that, of course, it's going to be very important. But there is one major argument which I have. All these stories of what EU do, what America do are important, but neither United States nor the European Union are the only players. Mm. There is even something kind of unfair trying to treat basically countries like Ukraine or others as being simply the place where the action is going to happen, but not being an actor. Talking about, for example, NATO, unfortunately, there never was an elite real consensus or public consensus on Ukraine joining NATO. You have a basically divided nation. This divided nation is a reality. And, of course, during the days of the Orange Revolution, we saw one, I do believe, the bigger part of it looking at Europe. It does not mean that the other part does not exist. So in 25 years, for me, the most important is first that the state-building exercise in Ukraine is going to succeed. And then when basically this is successful exercise, I easily can see basically Ukraine being in European Union, NATO, or any other organizations that we are going to invent them now. But to believe that we can solve all the state-building projects in the post-Soviet space or in the Balkans simply because these countries are going to be in one or the other organization, in my view, it's a kind of a Nietzscheanism on the foreign policy side where you believe that everything is just will on the side of the EU or US.
Yes, about Ukraine. my reading is not exactly yours. I don't think the problem was, you know, that there was a demand and the EU said no. I mean, it's been a process, and as Ivan said and as I said earlier, you know, you need to have a partnership, and the situation in Ukraine rapidly changed after the Orange Revolution, which made things more difficult in terms of negotiations. So I don't think one can say that the European Union made a decision one day that, you know, no, Ukraine would not become a member. And it was the same with a number of other states. So the question really is for a potential candidate to, you know, to have a strategy. And in Ukraine, we're waiting to see. You know, they certainly want to pursue a partnership with the European Union, but also are moving towards more agreements with Russia. And some of them that might stand in the way of the partnership with the European Union. So that's where, you know, we're facing a situation where, of course, a country can belong to several entities and communities, and but it's not always that easy to arrange, especially when you wish to still have an option to become a member of the European Union, which is the most organized and institutionalized one. So about the Council of Europe, I think the future of the Council of Europe doesn't have much to do with, you know, when with the European Union enlarge further, because this will take time, and the Council of Europe is a very, very different institution that could play a more efficient role today. And unfortunately, on a number of issues, the Council of Europe has not been terribly vocal or effective.
Yeah, you gonna offer anything on the...
Only on the, I mean, on the, Ukraine is an interesting case, and I think a number of us have said that, you know, we didn't view Yanukovych's election as a failure of the Orange Revolution, but a failure of its leaders. And I think the Orange Revolution certainly changed the goalposts and the political culture in Ukraine, and we're going to have to see how that evolves. But I agree with the other panelists that the biggest problem in Ukraine has been its own internal transformation. And if you just look at where it, you know, it has a very high rating, say, if you're trying to look at indicators, Freedom House on democracy has given it very high ratings. But if you look at corruption and you look at doing business, both the World Bank and Transparency International's ratings, you'll find Ukraine is near rock bottom on both of them. And that's within their power to do something about. So we're going to have to see how that goes. I think the other thing that Ivan made is the good point about it not being a zero-sum game, because it really isn't. And I think if you look at the comments on Ukraine from, you know, our Vice President Biden to, you know, the EU Commissioner for Enlargement, you'll find sort of the same riff that, you know, these countries have a right to make their own decisions. We support their sovereignty and independence, but also their right to choose, you know, who they want to associate with and which alliances they want to belong to. And I think that's a good place for both the EU and the United States to be.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and bring this session to an end. We have 30 minutes now for lunch, which is right next door. Please resume here at 1:30 when the last panel will meet. And please join me in thanking the panelists for their comments.